Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. Always a pleasure to be able to share the latest on health and healing with you. I'm a big believer in freedom of choice. However, what if the information you receive is not honest, not complete, not accurate? What if it's biased? Well, then the choice you make will frequently end up not being a good one. So we try as best as possible to give you the most accurate information, and we do a lot of research to make sure that we're giving you up-to-date information. For example, from Southern Medical University, published an article in Alzheimer's Research and Therapy talking about glucosamine. It's used to lower your risk of dementia. Now, glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate, along with sea cucumber, are the three very important nutrients supplements that you use if you have arthritis, or maybe you have knee problems, swollen knees, maybe you've been an athlete and overused them, and they really make a difference. That and emulsified cod liver oil on an empty stomach in the morning. This goes back a long ways. Now there's new research saying, hold on, you can use glucosamine in other ways, including to turn off inflammation in your brain, because glucosamine, that's glucosamine, can modulate inflammation anywhere in the body. And that means that it can create improvements in a range of chronic metabolic disorders, particularly obesity, type 2 diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. That's really important. And this study had 214,000 people, and it was over 12 years. And that is a really important study. So if you want to help reduce dementia, take glucosamine. Now from Appalachian State University, the first groundbreaking study shows how rhodiola, rosea, protects people from viral infections. Rhodiola is R-H-O-D-I-O-L-A. Rosea is R-O-S-E-A. It's also known as Arctic root or golden root, but you'll find it as rhodiola, rosea. It's already been shown to stimulate serotonin and norepinephrine and dopamine activity. It supports neurotransmitter balance, but it also helps fight against viral infections. So along with the quercetin, vitamin D3, zinc, and vitamin C and vitamin A, you have to add in now rhodiola, rosea, for any kind of flu or cold or anything viral. All right? And I would add it in now as a body protective mechanism, because a lot of people are getting COVID once again, and this is just one more quiver in the arsenal to fight it. It's natural. And also for those of you who are highly stressed, historically, rhodiola was shown to help stimulate dopamine and serotonin, which means you're going to have a more positive disposition. You're going to feel better, kind of euphoric. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Frontiers in Nutrition. And it's the first to show antiviral activity. That's good. And they got 600 milligrams of this or placebo for a month and made a big difference. Also from Washington University, obesity is now linked to 8 more types of cancer. Do you remember I started arguing the issue over 25 years ago that there is no such thing as being healthy and overweight? Now, of course, then you have all the individuals who then say, but I feel good about myself and I don't care if I'm overweight. There's no real science showing that being overweight is that bad. It's not settled. Well, that's not true. And I certainly don't want anyone feeling shamed, and we should never shame someone because they're overweight. But that does not negate the voluminous information showing if you're overweight, you're at greater risk of dying earlier. Almost certainly going to do so. And I worked with one of the most important cases in America, and it was all public, when Fred Fisher, who was a well-known actor, he played in The Bronx Tale with Robert De Niro, When I got the call from him, he weighed 747 pounds, and he had congestive heart failure. And his doctor said, if we don't give surgery, you're going to die. But if we do get surgery, based on your age and your weight, you're also going to die. So it's not a good situation. So he came to me to see if there was anything else in lifestyle and behavior he could do so he didn't require surgery. And so he decided he wanted, if he was going to die, at least let the world know what the risks are, the problems, how I got here, and so they'll learn a lesson, so my death will not be in vain. He was very upfront about it. He was not terrified. He didn't want to die. He was a very affable man, very gentle. He was a gentle giant. So I made it public, and so we started to film him and all of his changes. And over a period of about a year and a half, he lost over 450 pounds. And we were trying to get the funds together so he could have surgery to remove all these long and very heavy, probably weighed another 75 pounds in just skin. In any case, but when he went to the doctor and we filmed the doctor, no congestive heart failure, no 500 points on his cholesterol, no diabetes, no high blood pressure, no arthritis, no depression, no tachycardia. He had all these things. He was normal as normal can be. And went on to sit on the stoop of his building over in Brooklyn. And everyone, of course, knew him in the neighborhood. And he would talk with people and encourage them to do healthy things. He'd take him across the street where there was a health food store and show how he got his healthy juices each day there. So he, to his credit, probably influenced several thousand people in realizing, don't get overweight, because there's no such thing as being overweight and healthy. It's a myth. And we shouldn't make it some social phenomenon, as some women recently did, and they had millions of followers, and they're dead. Those women, leading movement, they're dead. And I don't want to see anyone die. I certainly don't want to see anyone die who didn't have to. So here's the message. There's brand new information. Just today I'm sharing it with you, that carrying any extra weight is a risk factor for 8 more types of cancer. And that's a review of over 1,000 medical studies. So the science is there. So obesity is now linked to an increased risk of developing cancer of the thyroid, liver, stomach, gallbladder, pancreas, and ovaries, and plus a melanoma and a type of brain tumor, and blood cancer. So let's keep ourselves healthy. It's in your best interest. And also from the University of Michigan, whole life expectancy rates for older adults are rising. Nearly 40% of adults report living with a digestive disease of some kind. Older adults with digestive disorders, ileitis, colitis, spastic colon, Crohn's disease, experience higher rates of loneliness and depression. And so by dealing with your depression and loneliness and taking a more holistic approach to digestion, you're able to live a longer life without this physical stress and emotional distress at the same time. Things like papaya and fennel and anise into a meal helps with digestion. Aloe vera after a meal helps with digestion and turns off inflammation in your gut. Probiotics help with vitamin C with Helicobacter E. pylori in the stomach that can cause stomach cancer. Taking your time when you eat. Stop drinking cold beverages with your meals. Go for a walk after a meal. These all help. That's it for health and nutrition. We're going to take a break and come right back. And always go to GaryNall.com. A lot of new information on there every day. And go to my show notes. A lot of articles and videos that I don't have time to put on the air. You can see, go to prn.fm, scroll down to archives, scroll down to Gary's notes. Back in a moment. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Think back. If you're a baby boomer like myself or a senior citizen older, the greatest generation, we have a lot of those people still around. What were some of the most inspirational moments? What were speeches, unique speeches? Something that our generations really appreciated. I can think back to the American University speech titled A Strategy of Peace. It was a commencement address delivered by the United States President John F. Kennedy at the American University in Washington, D.C. on Monday, June 10th, 1963. And it was inspiring. And I'm going to play it now. About a half a year ago, a group of activists, Gerald Salante was one of the leading ones, Medea Benjamin, Max Blumenthal, Aaron Mate, about 30 more or less speakers who all have outstanding reputation for being against war and against Ukrainian war and wanting peace, spent about a month promoting a rally in Washington, D.C. It had a terrible, I mean, really dismal outcome. Not their efforts and not their speeches, but rather there was such a lack of interest in the topic. Less than 3,000 people showed up. And I thought, wow, what has happened in America? Why aren't we interested in peace? So I'm going to play this clip because I consider this one of the most important speeches that I ever heard. And a lot of you probably never heard of it because it wasn't It's not the speech they put out there by John F. Kennedy. And by the way, he is not alone. There are other speeches that I believe that we should also listen to if we haven't. For example, I'm sure you're all familiar with Martin Luther King's speech, April 4th, 1967, at the Riverside Church, called Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence. And some would argue that Martin Luther King's I Had a Dream speech in August 28th, 1963 at the Lincoln Memorial was his most important speech. But the one that motivated me most was his Riverside speech. But think then of Dwight Eisenhower's January 17th, 1961 farewell speech. Boy, was that prophetic. He said, beware of the military-industrial complex. He was right. And then Lincoln, on November 19th, 1863, his Gettysburg address speech that ended the Civil War. And for the very old in the audience, it'll be FDR, January 15th, 1933, his inaugural address, when he said, first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance. And if you go further back, if you appreciate history, as many of you do, then what about Frederick Douglass's July 4th, 1852 speech in Rochester, New York, Hypocrisy of American Slavery speech, where he said, I will in the name of humanity, which is outraged in the name of liberty, which is fettered in the name of the Constitution and the Bible, which are disregarded and trampled upon, dare to call in question and to denounce with all the emphasis I can command everything that serves to perpetuate slavery. These are speeches that are rare, but what they do is they open a window into a universal truth that we were not meant to be engaged in slavery, wars. We were not meant to take advantage of others' weaknesses to exploit for our own gain. Instead, we were to be united and respectful and loving of our commonality as being sentient human beings. So for the younger people in this audience, I don't know if you've watched or heard any of these speeches, but if you haven't, I'm going to play you one of the most important, and just imagine how important it is today to remember John F. Kennedy's speech way back in 1963. Now to the speech.
President Anderson, members of the faculty, Board of Trustees, distinguished guests, my old colleague, Senator Bob Byrd, who has earned his degree through many years of attending Knight Law School, while I am earning mine in the next 30 minutes. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it is with great pride that I participate in this ceremony of the American University, sponsored by the Methodist Church, founded by Bishop John Fletcher Hurst, and first opened by President Woodrow Wilson in 1914. This is a young and growing university, but it has already fulfilled Bishop Hurst's enlightened hope for the study of history and public affairs in a city devoted to the making of history and to the conduct of the public's business. By sponsoring this institution of higher learning, for all who wish to learn, whatever their color or their creed, the Methodists of this area and the nation deserve the nation's thanks. And I commend all those who are today graduating. Professor Woodrow Wilson once said that every man sent out from a university should be a man of his nation as well as a man of his time. And I'm confident that the men and women who carry the honor of graduating from this institution will continue to give from their lives, from their talents, a high measure of public service and public support. There are few earthly things more beautiful than a university, wrote John Masefield in his tribute to English universities, and his words are equally true today. He did not refer to towers or to campuses. He admired the splendid beauty of a university because it was, he said, a place where those who hate ignorance may strive to know, where those who perceive truth may strive to make others see. I have therefore chosen this time and place to discuss a topic on which ignorance too often abounds and the truth too rarely perceived. And that is the most important topic on earth, peace. What kind of a peace do I mean, and what kind of a peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana, enforced on the world by American weapons of war. Not the peace of the grave or the security of the slave. I am talking about genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on earth worth living. The kind that enables men and nations to grow and to hope and build a better life for their children. Not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, but peace in all time. I speak of peace because of the new face of war. Total war makes no sense in an age where great powers can maintain large and relatively invulnerable nuclear forces and refuse to surrender without resort to those forces. It makes no sense in an age where a single nuclear weapon contains almost 10 times the explosive force delivered by all the Allied air forces in the Second World War. It makes no sense in an age when the deadly poisons produced by a nuclear exchange would be carried by wind and water and soil and seed to the far corners of the globe and to generations yet unborn. Today, the expenditure of billions of dollars every year on weapons acquired for the purpose of making sure we never need them is essential to the keeping of peace. But surely the acquisition of such idle stockpiles, which can only destroy and never create, is not the only, much less the most efficient, means of assuring peace. I speak of peace, therefore, as the necessary rational end of rational men. I realize the pursuit of peace is not as dramatic as the pursuit of war, and frequently the words of the pursuers fall on deaf ears, but we have no more urgent task. Some say that it is useless to speak of peace or world law or world disarmament, and that it will be useless until the leaders of the Soviet Union adopt a more enlightened attitude. I hope they do. I believe we can help them do it. But I also believe that we must re-examine our own attitudes as individuals and as a nation. For our attitude is as essential as theirs. And every graduate of this school, every thoughtful citizen who despairs of war and wishes to bring peace, should begin by looking inward, by examining his own attitude towards the possibilities of peace, towards the Soviet Union, towards the course of the Cold War, and towards freedom and peace here at home. First, examine our attitude towards peace itself. Too many of us think it is impossible. Too many think it is unreal. But that is a dangerous, defeatist belief. It leads to the conclusion that war is inevitable, that mankind is doomed, that we are gripped by forces we cannot control. We need not accept that view. Our problems are man-made. Therefore, they can be solved by man, and man can be as big as he wants. No problem of human destiny is beyond human beings. Man's reason and spirit have often solved the seemingly unsolvable, and we believe they can do it again. I am not referring to the absolute, infinite concept of universal peace and goodwill, of which some fantasies and fanatics dream. I do not deny the value of hopes and dreams, but we merely invite discouragement and incredulity by making that our only and immediate goal. Let us focus instead on a more practical, more attainable peace, based not on a sudden revolution in human nature, but on a gradual evolution in human institutions, on a series of concrete actions and effective agreements, which are in the interests of all concerned. There is no single simple key to this peace, no grand or magic formula to be adopted by one or two powers. Genuine peace must be the product of many nations, the sum of many acts. It must be dynamic, not static, changing to meet the challenge of each new generation. For peace is a process, a way of solving problems. With such a peace, there will still be quarrels and conflicting interests, as there are within families and nations. World peace, like community peace, does not require that each man love his neighbor. It requires only that they live together in mutual tolerance, submitting their disputes to a just and peaceful settlement. And history teaches us that enmities between nations, as between individuals, do not last forever. However fixed our likes and dislikes may seem, the tide of time and events will often bring surprising changes in the relations between nations and neighbors. So let us persevere. Peace need not be impractical, and war need not be inevitable. By defining our goal more clearly, by making it seem more manageable and less remote, we can help all people to see it, to draw hope from it, and to move irresistibly towards it. And second, let us re-examine our attitude towards the Soviet Union. It is discouraging to think that their leaders may actually believe what their propagandists write. It is discouraging to read a recent authoritative Soviet text on military strategy and find on page after page wholly baseless and incredible claims, such as the allegation that American imperialist circles are preparing to unleash different types of war, that there is a very real threat of a preventative war being unleashed by American imperialists against the Soviet Union, and that the political aims, and I quote, of the American imperialists are to enslave economically and politically the European and other capitalist countries, and to achieve world domination by means of aggressive war, unquote. Truly, as it was written long ago, the wicked flee when no man pursueth. Yet it is sad to read these Soviet statements, to realize the extent of the gulf between us. But it is also a warning to the American people not to fall into the same trap as the Soviets, not to see only a distorted and desperate view of the other side, not to see conflict as inevitable, accommodation as impossible, and communication as nothing more than an exchange of threats. No government or social system is so evil that its people must be considered as lacking in virtue. As Americans, we find communism profoundly repugnant as a negation of personal freedom and dignity. But we can still hail the Russian people for their many achievements in science and space, in economic and industrial growth, in culture, in acts of courage. Among the many traits the peoples of our two countries have in common, none is stronger than our mutual abhorrence of war. Almost unique, among the major world powers, we have never been at war with each other. And no nation in the history of battle ever suffered more than the Soviet Union in the Second World War. At least 20 million lost their lives. Countless millions of homes and families were burned or sacked. A third of the nation's territory, including two-thirds of its industrial base, was turned into a wasteland, a loss equivalent to the destruction of this country east of Chicago. Today, should total war ever break out again, no matter how, our two countries will be the primary target. It is an ironic but accurate fact that the two strongest powers are the two in the most danger of devastation. All we have built, all we have worked for, would be destroyed in the first 24 hours. And even in the Cold War, which brings burdens and dangers to so many countries, including this nation's closest allies, our two countries bear the heaviest burdens. For we are both devoting massive sums of money to weapons that could be better devoted to combat ignorance, poverty, and disease. We are both caught up in a vicious and dangerous cycle, with suspicion on one side breeding suspicion on the other, and new weapons begetting counterweapons. In short, both the United States and its allies, and the Soviet Union and its allies, have a mutually deep interest in a just and genuine peace and in holding the arms race. Agreements to this end are in the interests of the Soviet Union as well as ours. And even the most hostile nations can be relied upon to accept and keep those treaty obligations, and only those treaty obligations, which are in their own interest. So let us not be blind to our differences, but let us also direct attention to our common interests and the means by which those differences can be resolved. And if we cannot end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures, and we are all mortal. Third, let us re-examine our attitude towards the Cold War, remembering we're not engaged in a debate, seeking to pile up debating points. We are not here distributing blame or pointing the finger of judgment. We must deal with the world as it is, and not as it might have been had the history of the last 18 years been different. We must therefore persevere in the search for peace in the hope that constructive changes within the communist bloc might bring within reach solutions which now seem beyond us. We must conduct our affairs in such a way that it becomes in the communist interests to agree on a genuine peace. And above all, while defending our own vital interests. Nuclear powers must avert those confrontations which bring an adversary to a choice of either a humiliating retreat or a nuclear war. To adopt that kind of course in the nuclear age would be evidence only of the bankruptcy of our policy or of a collective death wish for the world. To secure these ends, America's weapons are non-provocative, carefully controlled, designed to deter, and capable of selective use. Our military forces are committed to peace and disciplined in self-restraint. Our diplomats are instructed to avoid unnecessary irritants and purely rhetorical hostility, for we can seek a relaxation of tensions without relaxing our guard. And for our part, we do not need to use threats to prove we are resolute. We do not need to jam foreign broadcasts out of fear our faith will be eroded. We are unwilling to impose our system on any unwilling people, but we are willing and able to engage in peaceful competition with any people on earth. Meanwhile, we seek to strengthen the United Nations to help solve its financial problems, to make it a more effective instrument for peace, to develop it into a genuine world security system, a system capable of resolving disputes on the basis of law, of ensuring the security of the large and the small, and of creating conditions under which arms can finally be abolished. At the same time, we seek to keep peace inside the non-communist world, where many nations, all of them our friends, are divided over issues which weaken Western unity, which invite communist intervention, or which threaten to erupt into war. Our efforts in West New Guinea, in the Congo, in the Middle East, and the Indian subcontinent have been persistent and patient, despite criticism from both sides. We have also tried to set an example for others by seeking to adjust small but significant differences with our own closest neighbors in Mexico and Canada. Speaking of other nations, I wish to make one point clear. We are bound to many nations by alliances. These alliances exist because our concern and theirs substantially overlap. Our commitment to defend Western Europe and West Berlin, for example, stands undiminished because of the identity of our vital interests. The United States will make no deal with the Soviet Union at the expense of other nations and other peoples, not merely because they are our partners, but also because their interests and ours converge. Our interests converge, however, not only in defending the frontiers of freedom, but in pursuing the paths of peace. It is our hope and the purpose of Allied policy to convince the Soviet Union that she too should let each nation choose its own future, so long as that choice does not interfere with the choices of others. The communist drive to impose their political and economic system on others is the primary cause of world tension today. For there can be no doubt that if all nations could refrain from interfering in the self-determination of others, the peace would be much more assured. This will require a new effort to achieve world law, a new context for world discussions. It will require increased understanding between the Soviets and ourselves. An increased understanding will require increased contact and communication. One step in this direction is the proposed arrangement for a direct line between Moscow and Washington to avoid on each side the dangerous delays, misunderstandings, and misreadings of others' actions which might occur at a time of crisis. We have also been talking in Geneva about our first step measures of arms controls designed to limit the intensity of the arms race and reduce the risk of accidental war. Our primary long-range interest in Geneva, however, is general and complete disarmament, designed to take place by stages, permitting parallel political developments to build the new institutions of peace, which would take the place of arms. The pursuit of disarmament has been an effort of this government since the 1920s. It has been urgently sought by the past three administrations. And however dim the prospects are today, we intend to continue this effort, to continue it in order that all countries, including our own, can better grasp what the problems and the possibilities of disarmament are. The only major area of these negotiations where the end is in sight, yet where a fresh start is badly needed, is in a treaty to outlaw nuclear tests. The conclusion of such a treaty, so near and yet so far, would check the spiraling arms race in one of its most dangerous areas. It would place the nuclear powers in a position to deal more effectively with one of the greatest hazards which man faces in 1963, the further spread of nuclear arms. It would increase our security. It would decrease the prospects of war. Surely this goal is sufficiently important to require our steady pursuit, yielding neither to the temptation to give up the whole effort, nor the temptation to give up our insistence on vital and responsible safeguards. I'm taking this opportunity, therefore, to announce two important decisions in this regard. First, Chairman Khrushchev, Prime Minister McMillan, and I have agreed that high-level discussions will shortly begin in Moscow, looking towards early agreement on a comprehensive test ban treaty. Our hope must be tempered. Our hopes must be tempered with the caution of history, but with our hopes go the hopes of all mankind. Second, to make clear our good faith and solemn convictions on this matter, I now declare that the United States does not propose to conduct nuclear tests in the atmosphere so long as other states do not do so. We will not. We will not be the first to resume. Such a declaration is no substitute for a formal binding treaty, but I hope it will help us achieve one. Nor would such a treaty be a substitute for disarmament, but I hope it will help us achieve it. Finally, my fellow Americans, let us examine our attitude towards peace and freedom here at home. The quality and spirit of our own society must justify and support our efforts abroad. We must show it in the dedication of our own lives. As many of you who are graduating today will have an opportunity to do by serving without pay in the Peace Corps abroad or in the proposed National Service Corps here at home. But wherever we are, we must all in our daily lives live up to the age-old faith that peace and freedom walk together. In too many of our cities today, the peace is not secure because freedom is incomplete. It is the responsibility of the executive branch at all levels of government, local, state, and national, to provide and protect that freedom for all of our citizens by all means within our authority. It is the responsibility of the legislative branch at all levels, wherever the authority is not now adequate, to make it adequate. And it is the responsibility of all citizens in all sections of this country to respect the rights of others and respect the law of the land. All this. All this is not unrelated to world peace. When a man's way please the Lord, the scriptures tell us, he maketh even his enemies to be at peace with him. And is not peace, in the last analysis, basically a matter of human rights, the right to live out our lives without fear of devastation, the right to breathe air, as nature provided it, the right of future generations to a healthy existence. While we proceed to safeguard our national interests, let us also safeguard human interests. And the elimination of war and arms is clearly in the interests of both. No treaty, however much it may be to the advantage of all, however tightly it may be worded, can provide absolute security against the risks of deception and evasion. But it can, if it is sufficiently effective in its enforcement, and it is sufficiently in the interest of its signers, offer far more security and far fewer risks than an unabated, uncontrolled, unpredictable arms race. The United States, as the world knows, will never start a war. We do not want a war. We do not now expect a war. This generation of Americans has already had enough, more than enough, of war and hate and oppression. We shall be prepared if others wish it. We shall be alert to try to stop it. But we shall also do our part to build a world of peace where the weak are safe and the strong are just. We are not helpless before that task or hopeless of its success. Confident and unafraid, we must labor on, not towards a strategy of annihilation, but towards a strategy of peace.
During the past 3+ years, those of us who care about the truth have examined every aspect of what we were told and demanded to follow the protocols of COVID created by Anthony Fauci and nameless scientists from around the world, and that we believed it would help guide us out of that pandemic, at least protect us. Unfortunately, when we began to look at each and every part of it separately, there were contradictions. We found that real independent science, not the corporatized science of the CDC, the FDA, U.S. Public Health Service, Anthony Fauci's National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease science, which is completely wrong. They had not done the work, and the work they had done, they hid. They disguised it. They lied about it. Scientist after scientist, heads of the CDC and the FDA said, these are safe and effective, as then the mass media, speaking as one, without challenge or question, said, take the vaccine, you won't be infected, you won't infect others, you can travel, go to theater, you're not on the list of restrictions. It was all lies. There was never a single study done, as we would later find out, prove that. But there was proof that it was dangerous, and they didn't want us to know that for 75 years. The FDA wanted to hide that information for 75 years, but we won in court, and now we're seeing hundreds of thousands of documents of all the different diseases and illnesses that the vaccines were cause. Now even more terrible information is coming out, showing that over the next 10 years, for each vaccine that you get, you increase the risks of dying. And most of that dying will come from myocarditis, endocarditis, strokes, clogged arteries with nanoparticles. And they knew this also in birth defects, in sterilization of men's sperm. They hid it, and yet they're not being held accountable. So when we went to write on this, and I wrote 3 important articles at the very beginning, there were voices saying, don't let Gary on BAI or Pacifica talk about COVID. It's misinformation. No. Everything is a matter of public record. I post every article, the articles to build up your immune system and the nutrients to do it and the diet to do it, like vitamin K, B3, zinc, selenium, vitamin C, quercetin. They were all now shown by thousands of studies to build up the immune system, making you less vulnerable to serious outcomes. And then I wrote about the drugs off-label use that were non-toxic that could also stop COVID. And I presented that, showing you hundreds of drugs, thousands of scientists, the institution, the peer-reviewed journals, and the number of patients. Yet none of this was reported. And we sent it out. And then all of the exposés. And I did over 42 articles, all with proper scholarship, listing all of the resources from the National Library of Medicine. So it was my opinion that I was offering. And yet none of this was spread, only on Global Research or Towns Letter for Physician. And no, we were right 100%. They were wrong 100%. And yet the voices, small number that they were, says, don't spread this on the airwaves. So instead, we got misinformation on the airwaves. We got hate on the airwaves. We got censorship efforts on the airwaves. How unfortunate. But now that has been exposed. I want you to watch this clip. Go to PRN.live, scroll down to archive, scroll down to Gary's show notes, and you'll watch a legislator called Josh Hawley, who is challenging a panel on the fact that the Biden administration, with specific instructions from the President of the United States, to ban anything that challenged the official COVID narrative. And every major media complied. All of the social media platforms, Google, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Wikipedia, all complied. And we wouldn't have known this if it weren't for the fact that under Twitter, when Elon Musk bought it, and they began to read the emails on a regular daily basis, every major government deep state agency, the CIA, the FBI, National Homeland Security, they were all in there saying, here's what you don't allow, censor this person. And censor Gary Knoll, censor, you know, Chris Hedges, Abby Martin, censor Matt Taibbi, etc. And but allow this information that we want on social media, but not letting the public know it came from us. So then we can use it saying, well, look, on YouTube and on Twitter, they're saying that this is good to do it. They did this, by the way, the vice president in 2003 did this to support the war in Iraq, the invasion of Iraq. So you were lied to on social media. Then why would you use it today? You were lied to by the mainstream media that with all of its resources, and highly educated and intelligent people, not one of them broke ranks to expose the corruption. You were lied to by people at the major networks, including the nonprofit networks like NPR and even these pro-vaccine advocates on Pacifica. Thank goodness we had Dr. Kakai and others who continue to share the truth. I commend them for that. So this shows you that everything you were being told was a lie, was propaganda. And the truth that we were presenting was not allowed to be seen. The algorithms wouldn't allow it. And now they've been found guilty. And they may take it to the Supreme Court, but up to this point, they've taken it to three courts and they've lost. So as of now, we have exposed their corruption, collusion, conspiracy. We've shown that the truth, by many different sources, was not allowed to be put forward. So shame on these social media platforms for their collusion and corruption, and shame on the government and the White House for their corruption and collusion, and good for the people who now know the truth. So go to the right platforms like Global Research and others that they don't control, and go over to Rumble and Odyssey to get the truth. Now to the clip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks to the witnesses for being here. I think it's safe to say that all of you are here today because you are opposed to government censorship. Is that right? Have I got that broadly correct? Okay, we can agree on that much. Book banning is a form of government censorship. Is that broadly speaking correct? Professor Knox, you're an expert in this. Let me just ask you. Book banning is a problem under the First Amendment because it's the government telling private individuals, authors, what have you, what they can and cannot write, telling the public what they can and cannot read. Is that broadly speaking correct?
Yes, that's correct.
So now what if the books were digital only? Could the government ban them then? So no hard copies, no physical copies, it's just digital books. Could the government engage in book banning then under the First Amendment? No problem.
No, that's about a format of the particular book, and that really doesn't matter when it comes to whether or not government is banning a book.
Okay, what if the government made a list of authors whose books it wanted banned and also went to all of the publishing houses in America, the government did, and said, do not publish the books by any of these authors or we will punish you. Is that a problem in the First Amendment?
My hope is that the government would not be involved in the decisions of a private company.
Good. I would hope so too, but apparently that is not the case in the United States of America today under this administration, because the hypotheticals I've just given you aren't hypotheticals at all. They've happened, and we know that they are happening. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals just ruled in a case, Missouri versus Biden. I'm sure you're all familiar with this. It's going to go down, I think, as a landmark case in the worst possible way in First Amendment law, because what the Court of Appeals found is that the White House, not just the federal government, but the White House actively coerced every major social media platform in America. Let me say that again. Every major social media platform in America to ban speech that the White House did not like. What are we talking about here? Well, we're talking about speech on the COVID-19 pandemic, speech on the 2022 congressional elections, speech related to mask mandates, speech related to vaccines. What did the White House do? Well, over a period of years, they met with, on a regular basis, the leaders of social media companies and demanded that the speech they did not like be taken down. They further demanded that these same social media companies amplify the White House's speech. Amazing. So take down all of this speech that we don't like, amplify our own speech. Unbelievable. What kind of speech are we talking about? Well, for example, not just public officials, but parents. Here's an example from my state, the state of Missouri. I'm reading you from the opinion here. One parent who posted on Nextdoor.com, which is a site operated by Facebook, posted an online petition to encourage his school to remain mask optional, found that his posts were removed without notifying him, and his friends never saw them. Another parent in the same school district who objected to mask mandates for school children responded to Dr. Fauci on Twitter and promptly received a warning from Twitter that his account would be banned if he did not delete the tweets criticizing Dr. Fauci's approach to mask mandates. These objections, amazingly, this censorship was taken at the direct behest of the federal government, the direct behest of the Biden administration. Professor Knox, is this a violation of the First Amendment?
Only a judge can make that determination.
And a judge has. I'm glad you said that. Multiple judges. The district court, federal district court, said there was a direct First Amendment violation. Court of Appeals unanimously, 3-judge panel, unanimously said direct First Amendment violation. I can't think of another time in American history when the president of the United States, and I say that advisedly because the record reflects that White House officials were sending emails and communications to these companies saying that the president himself wanted the censorship. So you've got the government doing exactly what Professor Knox said is not permitted under the First Amendment, directly coercing the speech of private parties, and not just one or two authors, but parents all across the country, unprecedented in the history of this nation. So I'm glad we're having this hearing today. I hope that we will have more like it to expose the censorship happening at the highest levels of our government. Mr. Chairman, I'd ask that this this opinion, this judgment by the Fifth Circuit, Missouri versus Biden, be entered into the record in full.
Without objection.
I will leave it there. I know there are other Senator Kennedys here who want to ask questions, but I just want to say for the record that this kind of censorship is un-American. It is unconstitutional, and I hope it will go down as a sad chapter in American history that we can close here and now. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Sobering, isn't it? And also, if you go to GaryNall.com, we're rearranging everything. It'll take us about 2 months, but we're putting everything into categories with videos and articles and photographs and exposés and essays, all in one place based upon, for example, if it's investigative reporting, all the investigative reports by categories. And you'll find dozens of articles against challenging Wikipedia and dozens of articles on vaccines, over 70. And you'll find articles on COVID. So now you have resources all qualified. You can use any of this material in a court of law. And I defy cross-examination to find a flaw in it. So you have resources to fight back. So you don't just offer an opinion. We will continue exposing the lies and sharing the truth. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening and watching, and we look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.